and her great ziggurat temple were no longer recognized. As the sixth year began, the omens concerning destruction became more urgent and more specific. When the sixth year comes, the inhabitants of Ur will be trapped, one omen stated. The prophesied calamity shall come, another omen stated. When for the second time, he who calls himself supreme, like one whose chest has been anointed, shall come from the west. That very year, as messages from the borders reveal, hostile westerners had entered the plain of Mesopotamia. Without resistance, they quickly entered the interior of the country, taking one by one all the great fortresses. All Ibi-Sin held on to was the enclave of Ur and Nippur. But before the fateful sixth year was out, the inscriptions honoring the king of Ur stopped abruptly, also in Nippur. The enemy of Ur and her gods, the one who calls himself supreme, had reached the heart of Sumer. Marduk, as the omens had predicted, returned to Babylon for the second time. The 24 fateful years since Abraham left Haran, since Shulgi was replaced on the throne, since Marduk's exile among the Hittites had begun, have all converged in that year of doom, 2024 BC. Having followed the separate but interconnected biblical tale of Abraham and the fortunes of Ur and its last three kings, we will now follow in the footsteps of Marduk. The tablet on which Marduk's autobiography is inscribed, from which we have already partly quoted, continues to relate his return to Babylon after the 24 years of sojourn in the land of Hatti. In Hatti land, I asked an oracle about my throne and my lordship. In its midst, I asked, until when? 24 years in its midst, I nested. Then in that 24th year, he received a favorable omen. My days of exile were completed. To my city I set my course, my temple Esagila as a mount, to raise, rebuild, my everlasting abode to reestablish. I raised my heels toward Babylon. Through lands I went to my city, her future well-being to establish, a king in Babylon to install in the house of my covenant, in the mount-like Esagil, by Anu created into the Esagil, a platform to raise, in my city, joy. The damaged tablet then lists the cities through which Marduk had passed on his way to Babylon. The few legible city names indicate that Marduk's route from Asia Minor to Mesopotamia took him first south to the city of Hama, the biblical Hamat, then eastward via Mari. He had indeed come to Mesopotamia, as the omens had predicted, from the west, accompanied by Amorite, westerners, supporters. His wish, Marduk continued, was to bring peace and prosperity to the land, chase away evil and bad luck, bring motherly love to mankind. But it all came to naught. Against his city, Babylon, an adversary god, his wrath had brought. The name of this adversary god is stated at the very beginning of a new column of the text, but all that has remained of it is the first syllable, divine Nin. The reference could have been only to Ninurta. We learn little from this tablet of the actions taken by this adversary, for all the subsequent verses are badly damaged, and the text becomes unintelligible. But we can pick up some of the missing threads from the third tablet of the Kedorlaomer texts. In spite of its enigmatic aspects, it paints a picture of total turmoil, with adversary gods marching against each other at the head of their human troops. The Amorite supporters of Marduk swooped down the Euphrates Valley toward Nippur, and Ninurta organized Elamite troops to fight them. We have found that to accuse an enemy of atrocities is not a modern innovation. The Babylonian text, written, we must keep bearing in mind, by a worshipper of Marduk, attributes to the Elamite troops, and to them alone, the desecration of temples, including the shrines of Shamash and Ishtar. The Babylonian chronicler goes even farther. He accuses Ninurta of falsely blaming on the followers of Marduk the desecration of Enlil's Holy of Holies in Nippur, thereby provoking Enlil to take sides against Marduk and his son Nabu. It happened, the Babylonian text relates, when the two opposing armies faced each other at Nippur. It was then that the holy city was despoiled, and its shrine, the Iker, desecrated. Ninurta accused the followers of Marduk of this evil deed, but it was not so. It was his ally Era who had done it. How Nergal Era suddenly appears in the Babylonian Chronicle will remain a puzzle until we return to the Era epic. But that this god is named in the Kadurlaomer texts and is accused of the defilement of the Iker, there can be no doubt. Era, the pitiless one, entered the sacred precinct. He stationed himself in the sacred precinct. He beheld the Iker. His mouth he opened. He said to his young men, "Carry off the spoil of Iker. Take away its valuables. Destroy its foundation. Break down the enclosure of the shrine." When Enlil, loftily enthroned, heard that his temple had been destroyed, its shrine defiled, that in the Holy of Holies the veil was torn away, he rushed back to Nippur. Riding in front of him were gods clothed with radiance. He himself set off brilliance like lightning as he came down from the skies, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 104. He made the holy place shake as he descended to the sacred precinct. Enlil then addressed himself to his son, the Prince Ninurta, to find out who had defiled the sacred place. But instead of telling the truth, that it was Era, his ally, Ninurta pointed the accusing finger at Marduk and his followers. Describing the scene, the Babylonian text asserts that Ninurta was acting without the required respect on meeting his father. Not fearing for his life, he removed not his tiara. To Enlil, evil he spoke. There was no justice. Destruction was conceived, and so provoked, Enlil against Babylon caused evil to be planned. In addition to the evil deeds against Marduk and Babylon, an attack against Nabu and his temple, Azida, in Borsippa, was also planned. But Nabu managed to escape westward, to the cities faithful to him near the Mediterranean Sea. From Azida, Nabu, to marshal all his cities, set his step. Toward the great sea he set his course. Now there follow verses in the Babylonian text that have a direct parallel in the biblical tale of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. But when the son of Marduk in the land of the coast was, he of the evil wind, Era, with heat, the plain land burnt. These are indeed verses that must have had a common source with the biblical description of how brimstone and fire rained from the skies, upheavaled those cities and the whole plain. As biblical statements attested, the wickedness of the cities of the Jordan plain was that they had forsaken the covenant of the Lord, and they went and served other gods. As we now learn from the Babylonian text, the outcry, accusation against them, was their rallying to the side of Marduk and Nabu in that last clash between the contending gods. But whereas the biblical text left it at that, the Babylonian text adds another important detail. The attack on the Canaanite cities was intended not only to destroy the centers of support for Marduk, but also to destroy Nabu, who had sought asylum there. However, that second aim was not achieved, for Nabu managed to slip out in time and escaped to an island in the Mediterranean, where the people accepted him, although he was not their god. He, Nabu, the great sea entered, sat upon a throne which was not his, because Azida, the legitimate abode, was overrun. The picture that can be gathered from the biblical and Babylonian texts of the cataclysm that engulfed the ancient Near East in the time of Abraham is much more fully detailed in the Era epic, to which we have already referred earlier. First pieced together from fragments found in the library of Ashurbanipal in Nineveh, the Assyrian text began to take shape and meaning as more fragmented versions were unearthed at other archaeological sites. But now it is definitely established that the text was inscribed on 5 tablets, and in spite of breaks, missing or incomplete lines, and even some disagreement among the scholars where some fragments belong, 2 extensive translations have been compiled, Das Era Epos by P.F. Gossmann, and L'Opéra d'Era by L. Cagni. The Era epic not only explains the nature and causes of the conflict that had led to the unleashing of the ultimate weapon against inhabited cities and the attempt to annihilate a god, Nabu, believed hiding therein, it also makes clear that such an extreme measure was not taken lightly. We know from several other texts that the great gods, at that time of acute crisis, were sitting in a continuous council of war, keeping constant communication with Anu. Anu to Earth, the words was speaking. Earth to Anu, the words pronounced. The Era epic adds the information that before the awesome weapons were used, one more confrontation had taken place between Nergal, Era, and Marduk, in which Nergal used threats to persuade his brother to leave Babylon and give up his claims to supremacy. But this time, persuasion failed, and back at the Council of the Gods, Nergal voiced the recommendation for the use of force to dislodge Marduk. We learn from the texts that the discussions were heated and acrimonious. From one day and one night, without ceasing, they went on. An especially violent argument developed between Enki and his son Nergal, in which Enki stood by his firstborn son. Now that Prince Marduk has arisen, now that the people for the second time have raised his image, why does Era continue his opposition? Enki asked. Finally, losing his patience, Enki shouted at Nergal to get out of his presence. Leaving in a huff, Nergal returned to his domain. Consulting with himself, he decided to unleash the awesome weapons. The lands I will destroy, to a dust heap make them. The cities I will upheaval, to desolation turn them. The mountains I will flatten, their animals make disappear. The seas I will agitate, that which teems in them I will decimate. The people I will make vanish, their souls shall turn to vapor. None shall be spared. We learn from a text known as CTXVI 44-46 that it was Gibel, whose domain in Africa adjoined that of Nergal, who alerted Marduk to the destructive scheme hatched by Nergal. It was nighttime, and the great gods had adjourned for rest. It was then that Gibel these words to Marduk did speak, in regard to the seven awesome weapons by which Anu were created. The wickedness of those seven against thee is being laid, he informed Marduk. Alarmed, Marduk inquired of Gibel where the awesome weapons were kept. O Gibel, he said, those seven. Where were they born? Where were they created? To which Gibel revealed that they were hidden, underground. Those seven in the mountain they abide. In a cavity inside the earth they dwell. From this place, with a brilliance, they will rush forth, from heaven to earth, clad with terror. But where exactly is this place? Marduk asked again and again, and all Gibel could say was that, even the wise gods, to them it is unknown. Now Marduk rushed to his father Enki with the frightening report. To his father Enki's house he, Marduk, entered. Enki was lying on a couch in the chamber to which he retired for the night. My father, Marduk said, Gibel, this word hath spoken to me, of the coming of the seven weapons he has found out. Telling his father the bad news, he urged his all-knowing father, their place to search out, do hasten thou. Soon the gods were back in council, for even Enki knew not the exact hiding place of the ultimate weapons. To his surprise, not all the other gods were as shocked as he was. Enki spoke out strongly against the idea, urging steps to stop Nergal. For the use of the weapons, he pointed out, the lands would make desolate. The people will make perish. Nannar and Utu wavered as Enki spoke, but Enlil and Ninurta were for decisive action. And so, with the Council of the Gods in disarray, the decision was left to Anu. When Ninurta finally arrived in the lower world with word of Anu's decision, he found out that Nergal had already ordered the priming of the seven awesome weapons, with their poisons, their nuclear warheads. Though the Era epic keeps referring to Ninurta by the epithet Ishum, the Scorcher, it relates in great detail how Ninurta had made clear to Nergal, Era, that the weapons could be used only against specifically approved targets, that before they could be used, the Anunnaki gods at the selected sites and the Agigi gods manning the space platform and the shuttlecraft had to be forewarned, and last but not least, mankind had to be spared, for Anu, lord of the gods on the land, had pity. At first, Nurgle balked at the very idea of forewarning anyone, and the ancient text goes to some length to relate the tough words exchanged between the two gods. Nurgle then agreed to giving advance warning to the Anunnaki and Agigi who manned the space facilities, but not to Marduk and his son Nabu, nor to the human followers of Marduk. It was then that Ninurta, attempting to dissuade Nurgle from indiscriminate annihilation, used words identical to those attributed in the Bible to Abraham when he tried to have Sodom spared. Valiant Era, will you the righteous destroy with the unrighteous? Will you destroy those who have against you sinned, together with those who against you have not sinned? Employing flattery, threats, and logic, the two gods argued back and forth on the extent of the destruction. More than Ninurta, Nurgle was consumed by personal hatred. I shall annihilate the son, and let the father bury him. Then I shall kill the father. Let no one bury him, he shouted. Employing diplomacy, pointing out the injustice of indiscriminate destruction and the strategic merits of selective targeting, the words of Ninurta finally swayed Nurgle. He heard the words spoken by Ishum, Ninurta. The words appealed to him as fine oil. Agreeing to leave alone the seas, to leave Mesopotamia out of the attack, he formulated a modified plan. The destruction will be selective. The tactical aim will be to destroy the cities where Nabu might be hiding. The strategic aim will be to deny to Marduk his greatest prize, the spaceport, the place from where the great ones ascend. From city to city an emissary I will send. The son, seed of his father, shall not escape. His mother shall cease her laughter. To the place of the gods, access he shall not have. The place from where the great ones ascend, I shall upheaval. When Nurgle finished presenting this latest plan, involving as it did the destruction of the spaceport, Ninurta was speechless. But as other texts assert, Enlil approved the plan when it was brought to his decision. So also apparently did Anu. Wasting no more time, Nurgle then urged Ninurta that the two of them go at once into action. Then did the hero Era go ahead of Ishum. Remembering his words, Ishum too went forth, in accordance with the word given, a squeezing in his heart. Their first target was the spaceport, its command complex hidden in the Mount Most Supreme, its landing field spread in the adjoining Great Plain. Ishum to Mount Most Supreme set his course. The awesome seven, weapons without parallel, trailed behind him. At the Mount Most Supreme, the hero arrived. He raised his hand. The mount was smashed. The plain by the Mount Most Supreme he then obliterated. In its forests, not a tree stem was left standing. So with one nuclear blow, the spaceport was obliterated. The mount within which its controls were hidden, smashed. The plain that served its runways, obliterated. It was a destructive feat, the written record attests, performed by Ninurta, Ishum. Now it was the turn of Nurgle, Era, to give vent to his vow of vengeance. Guiding himself from the Sinai Peninsula to the Canaanite cities by following the King's Highway, Era upheavaled them. The words employed by the Era epic are almost identical to those used in the biblical tale of Sodom and Gomorrah. Then, emulating Ishum, Era, the king's highway, followed. The cities he finished off. To desolation he overturned them. In the mountains he caused starvation. Their animals he made perish. The verses that follow may well describe the creation of the new southern portion of the Dead Sea, by breaking through its southern shoreline, and the elimination of all marine life therein. He dug through the sea. Its wholeness he divided. That which lives in it, even the crocodiles, he made wither. As with fire, he scorched the animals, banned its grains to become as dust. The Era epic thus encompasses all the three aspects of the nuclear event: the obliteration of the spaceport in the Sinai, the overturning, upheavaling, in the Bible, of the cities of the Jordan Plain, and the breach in the Dead Sea, resulting in its extension southward. One could expect that such a unique destructive event would have been recorded and mentioned in more than a single text. And indeed, we find descriptions and recollections of the nuclear upheaval in other texts as well. One such text is especially valuable, because it is in the original Sumerian language, and moreover, it is a bilingual text in which the Sumerian is accompanied by a line-by-line Akkadian translation. It is thus undoubtedly one of the earliest texts on the subject, and its wording indeed gives the impression that it is this, or similar Sumerian originals, that had served as a source for the biblical narrative. Addressed to a god, whose identity is not clear from the fragment, it says, "Lord, bearer of the scorcher, that burnt up the adversary, who obliterated the disobedient land, who withered the life of the evil word's followers, who rained stones and fire upon the adversaries." The deed performed by the two gods, Ninurta and Nergal, when the Anunnaki guarding the spaceport forewarned, had to escape by ascending to the dome of heaven, was recalled in a Babylonian text in which one king recalled the momentous events that had taken place in the reign of an earlier king. Here are the king's words. "At that time, in the reign of a previous king, conditions changed. Good departed, suffering was regular. The Lord of the gods became enraged. He conceived wrath. He gave the command. The gods of that place abandoned it. The two, incited to commit the evil, made its guardian stand aside. Its protectors went up to the dome of heaven." The Kedor-Laomer text, which identifies the two gods by their epithets as Ninurta and Nergal, tells it this way. "Enlil, who sat enthroned in loftiness, was consumed with anger. The devastators again suggested evil. He who scorches with fire, Ishum, Ninurta, and he of the evil wind, Era, Nergal, together performed their evil. The two made the gods flee, made them flee the scorching. The target from which they made the gods guarding it flee was the place of launching. That which was raised towards Anu to launch, they caused to wither. Its face they made fade away. Its place they made desolate. Thus was the spaceport, the prize over which so many wars of the gods had been fought, obliterated. The mount within which the controlling equipment was placed was smashed. The launch platforms were made to fade off the face of the earth. And the plain, whose hard soil the shuttlecraft had used as runways, was obliterated, with not even a tree left standing. The great place was never to be seen again, but the scar made in the face of the earth that awesome day can still be seen to this very day. It is a vast scar, so vast that its features can be seen only from the skies, revealed only in recent years as satellites began to photograph the earth, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 105. It is a scar for which no scientist has hitherto offered an explanation. Stretching north of this enigmatic feature in the face of the Sinai Peninsula is the flat central plain of the Sinai, a remnant of a lake from an earlier geological era. Its flat, hard soil is ideal for the landing of shuttlecraft, the very same reason which made the Mojave Desert in California and the Edwards Air Force Base there ideal for the landing of America's space shuttles. As one stands in this great plain in the Sinai Peninsula, its hard, flat soil having served for tank battles in recent history, as it did the shuttlecraft in antiquity, one can see in the distance the mountains that surround the plain and give it its oval shape. The limestone mountains loom white on the horizon. But where the great central plain adjoins the immense scar in the Sinai, the hue of the plain, black, stands out in sharp contrast to the surrounding whiteness, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading, Figure 106. Black is not a natural hue in the Sinai Peninsula, where the whiteness of the limestone and the redness of the sandstone combine to dazzle the eye with hues ranging from bright yellow to light gray and dark brown. But nowhere the black, which comes in nature from basalt stones. Yet here, in the central plain north-northeast of the enigmatic giant scar, the soil's color has a black hue. It is caused, as our photograph clearly shows, by millions upon millions of bits and pieces of blackened rock, strewn as by a giant hand over the whole area, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 107. There has been no explanation for the colossal scar in the face of the Sinai Peninsula, since it was observed from the skies and photographed by NASA satellites. There has been no explanation for the blackened bits and pieces of rock strewn over the area in the central plain. No explanation unless one reads the verses of the ancient texts and accepts our conclusion that in the days of Abraham, Nergal, and Ninurta, wiped out the spaceport that was there with nuclear weapons. That which was raised towards Anu to launch, they caused to wither. Its face they made fade away. Its place they made desolate. And the spaceport, even the evil cities, were no more. Far away to the west, in Sumer itself, the nuclear blasts and their brilliant flashes were neither felt nor seen. But the deed done by Nergal and Ninurta had not gone unrecorded, for it turned out to have had a most profound effect on Sumer, its people, and its very existence. For in spite of all the efforts of Ninurta to dissuade Nergal from harming mankind, a great suffering did ensue. Though the two had not intended it, the nuclear explosion gave rise to an immense wind, a radioactive wind, which began as a whirlwind. A storm, the evil wind, went around in the skies. And then the radioactive whirlwind began to spread and move westward with the prevailing winds blowing from the Mediterranean. Soon thereafter, the omens predicting the end of Sumer came true, and Sumer itself became the ultimate nuclear victim. The catastrophe that befell Sumer at the end of Ibi-Sin's sixth year of reign is described in several lamentation texts, long poems that bewail the demise of the majestic Ur and the other centers of the great Sumerian civilization, bringing very much to mind the biblical Book of Lamentations, lamenting the destruction of Jerusalem by the hands of the Babylonians. The Sumerian Lamentations suggested to the scholars who had first translated them that the Mesopotamian catastrophe was also the result of an invasion, this one by clashing Elamite and Amorite troops. When the first lamentation tablets were found, the scholars believed that Ur alone suffered destruction, and they titled the translations accordingly. But as more texts were discovered, it was realized that Ur was neither the only city affected, nor the focal point of the catastrophe. Not only were similar lamentations found bewailing the fate of Nippur, Uruk, Eridu, but some of the texts also provided lists of the affected cities. They appeared to begin in the southwest and extend to the northeast, encompassing the whole of southern Mesopotamia. It became apparent that a general, sudden, and concurrent catastrophe had befallen all the cities, not in slow succession, as would happen in the case of a progressive invasion, but all at once. Such scholars as T.H. Jacobson then concluded that the barbarian invaders had nothing to do with the dire catastrophe, a calamity he called really quite puzzling. Whether we shall ever see with full clarity what happened in those years, Jacobson wrote, only time will tell. The full story, we are convinced, is still far beyond our grasp. But the puzzle can be solved, and the full story grasped, if we relate the catastrophe in Mesopotamia to the nuclear explosion in the Sinai. The texts, remarkable for their length and in many instances also in excellent state of preservation, usually begin by bewailing the abrupt abandonment of all of Sumer's sacred precincts by their various gods, their temples abandoned to the wind. The desolation caused by the catastrophe is then described vividly by such verses as these, causing cities to be desolated, causing houses to become desolate, causing stalls to be desolate, the sheepfolds to be emptied, that Sumer's oxen no longer stand in their stalls, that its sheep no longer roam in its sheepfolds, that its rivers flow with water that is bitter, that its cultivated fields grow weeds, that its steppes grow withering plants. In the cities and the hamlets, the mother cares not for her children, the father says not, O my wife, the young child grows not sturdy on their knee, the nursemaid chants not a lullaby. Kingship has been taken away from the land. Before World War II had ended, before Hiroshima and Nagasaki were upheavaled with atomic weapons rained on them from the skies, one could still read the biblical tale of Sodom and Gomorrah and leave the traditional sulfur and brimstone for lack of a better explanation. To scholars who had not yet come face to face with the awesomeness of nuclear weapons, the Sumerian lamentation texts bespoke, as the scholars titled them, the destruction of Ur, or the destruction of Sumer. But that is not what these texts describe. They describe desolation, not destruction. The cities were there, but without people. The stalls were there, but without cattle. The sheepfolds remained, but were empty. The rivers flowed, but their waters became bitter. The fields still stretched, but they grew only weeds. And on the steppe the plants sprouted, only to wither away. Invasion, war, killing, all those evils were well known to mankind by then. But, as the lamentation texts clearly state, this one was unique and never experienced before. On the land Sumer fell a calamity, one unknown to man, one that had never been seen before, one which could not be withstood. The death was not by the hand of an enemy. It was an unseen death which roams the street, is let loose in the road. It stands beside a man, yet none can see it. When it enters a house, its appearance is unknown. There was no defense against this evil which has assailed the land like a ghost. The highest wall, the thickest walls, it passes as a flood. No door can shut it out. No bolt can turn it back. Through the door like a snake it glides. Through the hinge like a wind it blows in. Those who hid behind doors were felled inside. Those who ran to the rooftops died on the rooftops, and those who fled to the streets were stricken in the streets. Cough and phlegm weakened the chest. The mouth was filled with spittle and foam. Dumbness and days have come upon them, an unwholesome numbness, an evil curse, a headache. Their spirit abandoned their bodies. As they died, it was a most gruesome death. The people, terrified, could hardly breathe. The evil wind clutched them. Does not grant them another day. Mouths were drenched in blood, heads wallowed in blood, the face was made pale by the evil wind. The source of the unseen death was a cloud that appeared in the skies of Sumer and covered the land as a cloak, spread over it like a sheet. Brownish in color during the daytime, the sun in the horizon it obliterated with darkness. At night, luminous at its edges, girt with dread brilliance, it filleth the broad earth. It blocked out the moon. The moon at its rising it extinguished. Moving west to east, the deathly cloud, enveloped in terror, casting fear everywhere, was carried to Sumer by a howling wind, a great wind, which speeds high above, an evil wind which overwhelms the land. It was not, however, a natural phenomenon. It was a great storm directed from Anu. It hath come from the heart of Enlil. The product of the seven awesome weapons, in a single spawning, it was spawned. Like the bitter venom of the gods, in the west it was spawned. The evil wind, bearing gloom from city to city, carrying dense clouds that bring gloom from the sky, was the result of a lightning flash. From the midst of the mountains it had descended upon the land. From the plain of no pity it hath come. Though the people were baffled, the gods knew the cause of the evil wind. An evil blast heralded the baleful storm. An evil blast the forerunner of the baleful storm was. Mighty offspring, valiant sons, were the heralds of the pestilence. The two valiant sons, Ninurta and Nergal, unleashed in a single spawning the seven awesome weapons created by Anu, uprooting everything, upheavaling everything, at the place of the blast. The ancient descriptions are as vivid, as accurate as modern eyewitness descriptions of an atomic explosion. As soon as the awesome weapons were launched from the skies, there was an immense brilliance. They spread awesome rays towards the four points of the earth, scorching everything like fire, one text stated. Another, a lamentation over Nippur, recalled the storm, in a flash of lightning created. An atomic mushroom, a dense cloud that brings gloom, then rose to the sky. It was followed by rushing wind gusts, a tempest that furiously scorches the heavens. Then the prevailing winds, blowing from west to east, began to spread toward Mesopotamia. The dense clouds that bring gloom from the sky, that bear the gloom from city to city. Not one, but several texts attest that the evil wind, bearing the cloud of death, was caused by gigantic explosions on a day to remember. On that day, when heaven was crushed and the earth was smitten, its face obliterated by the maelstrom, when the skies were darkened and covered as with a shadow. The lamentation texts identified the site of the awesome blasts as in the west, near the breast of the sea, a graphic description of the curving Mediterranean coast at the Sinai Peninsula. From a plain in the midst of the mountains, a plain that became a place of no pity. It was a place that served before as the place of launching, the place from which the gods ascended toward Anu. In addition, a mount also featured in many of these place identifications. In the Ara epic, the mount near the place from which great ones ascend was called the Mount Most Supreme. In one of the lamentations, it was called the Mount of Howling Tunnels. This last epithet brings to mind the description in the pyramid texts of the tunneled mount with sloping underground passages to which Egyptian pharaohs journeyed in search of an afterlife. In the Stairway to Heaven, we have identified it with the Mount Gilgamesh had reached in his journey to the place of the rocket ships in the Sinai Peninsula. Starting from that mount, a lamentation text stated, "The blast's deadly cloud was carried by the prevailing winds eastward all the way to the boundary of Anshan, in the Zagros Mountains, affecting all of Sumer from Eridu in the south to Babylon in the north. The unseen death moved slowly over Sumer, its passage lasting 24 hours, a day and a night that were commemorated in laments, as in this one from Nippur. On that day, on that single day, on that night, on that single night, the storm in a flash of lightning created, the people of Nippur left prostrate." The Uruk lament vividly describes the confusion among both the gods and the populace, stating that Anu and Enlil had overruled Enki and Ninki when they determined the consensus to employ the nuclear weapons. The text asserts that none of the gods anticipated the awesome outcome. The great gods paled at its immensity as they witnessed the explosion's gigantic rays reach up to heaven and the earth tremble to its core. As the evil wind began to spread to the mountains as a net, the gods of Sumer began to flee their beloved cities. The text, known as Lamentation over the Destruction of Ur, lists all the great gods and some of their important sons and daughters who had abandoned to the wind the cities and great temples of Sumer. The text called Lamentation over the Destruction of Sumer and Ur adds dramatic details to this hurried abandonment. Thus Ninhursag wept in bitter tears as she escaped from Isin. Nanshi cried, "O my devastated city," as her beloved dwelling place was given over to misfortune. Inanna hurriedly departed from Uruk, sailing off toward Africa in a submersible ship and complaining that she had to leave behind her jewelry and other possessions. In her own lamentation for Uruk, Inanna Ishtar bewailed the desolation of her city and her temple by the evil wind, which in an instant, in a blink of an eye, was created in the midst of the mountains, and against which there was no defense. A breathtaking description of the fear and confusion among the gods and men alike, as the evil wind approached, is given in the Uruk Lament text, which was written years later, as the time of restoration came. As the loyal citizens of Uruk were seized with terror, the resident deities of Uruk, those in charge of the city's administration and welfare, set off an alarm. "Rise up," they called to the people in the middle of the night. "Run away. Hide in the steppe," they instructed them. But then these gods themselves, the deities, ran off. They took unfamiliar paths. Gloomily, the text states, "Thus all its gods evacuated Uruk. They kept away from it. They hid in the mountains. They escaped to the distant plains." In Uruk, the populace was left in chaos, leaderless and helpless. Mob panic was brought about in Uruk. Its good sense was distorted. The shrines were broken in and their contents were smashed as the people asked questions. Why did the gods' benevolent eye look away? Who caused such worry and lamentation? But their questions remained unanswered, and when the evil storm passed over, the people were piled up in heaps. A hush settled over Uruk like a cloak. Ninki, we learn from the Eridu lament, flew away from her city to a safe haven in Africa. Ninki, its great lady, flying like a bird, left her city. But Enki left Eridu only far enough to get out of the evil wind's way, yet near enough to see its fate. Its lord stayed outside his city. Father Enki stayed outside the city. For the fate of his harmed city, he wept with bitter tears. Many of his loyal subjects followed him, camping on its outskirts. For a day and a night, they watched the storm put its hand on Eridu. After the evil-bearing storm went out of the city, sweeping across the countryside, Enki surveyed Eridu. He found a city smothered with silence, its residents stacked up in heaps. Those who were saved addressed to him in lament. "O Enki," they cried out, "thy city has been cursed, made like an alien territory." And they kept on asking, whence should they go? What should they do? But though the evil wind had passed, the place was still unsafe, and Enki stayed out of his city as though it were an alien city. Forsaking the house of Eridu, Enki then led those who have been displaced from Eridu to the desert, towards an inimical land. There he used his scientific powers to make the foul tree edible. From the northern edge of the evil wind's wide swath, from Babylon, a worried Marduk sent his father Enki an urgent message as the cloud of death neared his city. "What am I to do?" he asked. Enki's advice, which Marduk then related to his followers, was that those who could should leave the city, but go only north, and in line with the advice given by the two emissaries to Lot, the people fleeing Babylon were warned neither to turn nor to look back. They were also told not to take with them any food or beverage, for these might have been touched by the ghost. If escape was not possible, Enki advised hiding underground. "Get thee into a chamber below the earth, into a darkness, until the evil wind was gone." The storm's slow advance misled some of the gods into costly delays. In Lagash, Mother Bao wept bitterly for her holy temple, for her city. Though Ninurta was gone, his spouse could not force herself to leave. Lingering behind, "Oh, my city, oh, my city," she kept crying. The delay almost cost her her life. On that day, the lady, the storm caught up with her. Bao, as if she were mortal, the storm caught up with her. In Ur, we learn from the Lamentations, one of which was composed by Ningal herself, that Ninar and Ningal refused to believe that the end of Ur was irrevocable. Nannar addressed a long and emotional appeal to his father Enlil, seeking some means to avert the calamity. But Enlil answered his son, Sin, that the fate could not be changed. Ur was granted kingship. It was not granted an eternal reign. Since days of yore, when Sumer was founded, to the present, when people have multiplied, who has ever seen a kingship of everlasting reign? While the appeals were made, Ningal recalled in her long poem, the storm was ever breaking forward, its howling overpowering all. It was daytime when the evil wind approached Ur, although of that day I still tremble, Ningal wrote. Of that day's foul smell, we did not flee. As night came, a bitter lament was raised in Ur. Yet the god and goddess stayed on. Of that night's foulness, we did not flee, the goddess stated. Then the affliction reached the great ziggurat of Ur, and Ningal realized that Nannar had been overtaken by the evil storm. Ningal and Nannar spent a night of nightmare, which Ningal vowed never to forget, in the termite house, underground chamber within the ziggurat. Only next day, when the storm was carried off from the city, did Ningal, in order to go from her city, hastily put on a garment, and together with the stricken Nannar departed from the city they so loved. As they were leaving, they saw death and desolation. The people, like potsherds, filled the city streets. In its lofty gates, where they were wont to promenade, dead bodies were lying about. In its boulevards, where the feasts were celebrated, scattered they lay. In all of its streets, where they were wont to promenade, dead bodies were lying about. In its places where the land's festivities took place, the people lay in heaps. The dead were not brought to burial. The dead bodies, like fat placed in the sun, of themselves melted away. Then did Ningal raise her great lamentation for Ur, the once majestic city, the head city of Sumer, capital of an empire. O house of sin in Ur, bitter is thy desolation. O Ningal, whose land has perished, make thy heart like water. The city has become a strange city. How can one now exist? The house has become a house of tears. It makes my heart like water. Ur and its temples have been given over to the wind. All of southern Mesopotamia lay prostrate, its soil and waters left poisoned by the evil wind. On the banks of the Tigris and Euphrates, only sickly plants grew. In the swamps grow sickly-headed reeds that rot in the stench. In the orchards and gardens there is no new growth. Quickly they waste away. The cultivated fields are not hoed. No seeds are implanted in the soil. No songs resound in the fields. In the countryside, the animals were also affected. On the steppe, cattle, large and small, become scarce. All living creatures come to an end. The domesticated animals, too, were wiped out. The sheepfolds have been delivered to the wind. The hum of the turning churn resounds not in the sheepfold. The stalls provide not fat and cheese. Ninurta has emptied Sumer of milk. The storm crushed the land, wiped out everything. It roared like a great wind over the land. None could escape it, desolating the cities, desolating the houses. No one treads the highways. No one seeks out the roads. The desolation of Sumer was complete. Epilogue. 7 years after the evil wind had desolated Sumer, life began to stir again in the land. But instead of an empire ruling others, Sumer itself was now an occupied land, with a semblance of order maintained by Elamite troops in the south and Gutian soldiers in the north. Isin, a city never a capital before, was selected as a temporary administrative center, and a former governor of Mari was brought over to rule the land. Documents from that time recorded a complaint that one who is not of Sumerian seed was given the reins over Sumer. As his Semitic name, Ishbi-Era, attested, he was a follower of Nergal, and his appointment must have been part of the arrangement between Nergal and Ninurta. Some scholars call the decades that followed the demise of Ur a dark age in Mesopotamian history. Little is known of those trying times except for what is gleaned from the yearly date formulas. Improving security, restoring here and there, Ishbi Era, seeking to solidify his secular authority, dismissed the foreign garrison that patrolled Ur, and by extending his reign to that city, laid claim to being a successor to the kings of Ur. But only a few other resettled cities acknowledged his supremacy, and at Larsa, a powerful local chief posed, at times, a challenge. A year or two later, Ishbi Era sought to add the central religious authority to his powers by assuming the guardianship of Nippur, raising there the sacred emblems of Enlil and Ninurta. But the permission for that came from Ninurta alone, and the great gods of Nippur remained aloof and alienated. Seeking other support, Ishbi Era appointed priests and priestesses to restore the worship of Ninar, Ningal, and Inanna. But it seems that the hearts of the people belonged elsewhere, as numerous Sherpu purification texts suggest. It was Enki and Marduk, using Enki's immense scientific knowledge, magical powers in the eyes of the people, who cured the afflicted, purified the waters, and made the soil grow edible vegetation again. For the next half century, embracing the reign of two successors, of Ishbi Era at Isin, normalcy gradually returned to the land. Agriculture and industry revived, internal and external trade resumed. But it was only after the passage of 70 years since its defilement, the same interval that later on applied to the desecrated temple in Jerusalem, that the temple of Nippur could be rebuilt by the third successor on the throne of Isin, Ishmi Dagon. In a long poem of 12 stanzas dedicated to Nippur, he described how its divine couple responded to his appeals to restore the city and its great temple, so that Nippur's brickwork be restored and the divine tablets be returned to Nippur. There was great jubilation in the land when the great temple was rededicated to Enlil and Ninlil in the year 1953 BC. It was only then that the cities of Sumer and Akkad were officially declared habitable again. The official return to normalcy, however, only served to stir up old rivalries among the gods. The successor to Ishmi Dagon bore a name indicating his allegiance to Ishtar. Ninurta put a quick end to that. And the next ruler at Isin, the last one ever to bear a Sumerian name, was one of his followers. But this claim of Ninurta to the restored land could not be upheld. After all, he had caused, even if indirectly, Sumer's destruction. As the next successor's name suggests, Sin then sought to reassert his authority, but the days of his and Ur's supremacy were over. And so, by the authority vested in them, Anu and Enlil finally accepted Marduk's claim to supremacy at Babylon, commemorating the fateful decision in the preamble to his law code. The Babylonian king Hammurabi put it in these words: "Lofty Anu, lord of the gods, who from heaven came to earth, and Enlil, lord of heaven and earth, who determines the destinies of the land, determined for Marduk, the firstborn of Enki, the Enlil functions over all mankind, made him great among the gods who watch and see, called Babylon by name to be exalted, made it supreme in the world, and established for Marduk, in its midst, an everlasting kingship." Babylon, then Assyria, rose to greatness. Sumer was no more. But in a distant land, the baton of its legacy passed from the hands of Abraham and Isaac, his son, unto the hand of Jacob, the one renamed Israel. This concludes The Wars of Gods and Men by Zechariah Sitchin, narrated by Stephen Bell Davies. Copyright 1990, 1991, 2002 by Zechariah Sitchin. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Inner Traditions International Limited, and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.